America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day where the great majority of the American people do not favor hate speech. They're opposed to it. But if somebody in a high school classroom uses the term illegal alien and doesn't use it insultingly, doesn't use it with any ethnic connotations, just basically says it in discussing the word alien and how it's used. Is that an offense that should lead to a suspension? There is a lawsuit coming on from the parents of the North Carolina young man who received a suspension from school and a good deal of humiliation for daring to use the term illegal alien. So why didn't he say undocumented citizen or undocumented resident? Because he wanted to make a point about the term alien. We will get into that coming up on the Michael Medved Show. We'll also be speaking to Jonathan Allen of NBC News, who will bring us some of the latest from the campaign trail. Part of that is that at a private donor event, President Trump likened the Biden administration to the Gestapo and the secret police force of Nazi Germany in remarks at a private closed-door donor retreat. That was over the weekend. At a private donor retreat, Trump team says Minnesota and Virginia are in play. Those are both states that carried fairly comfortably for Joe Biden last time. Top officials for former President Donald Trump's campaign believe they can flip Democratic strongholds, Minnesota and Virginia, into his column in November. They told donors behind closed doors at a Republican National Committee retreat over the weekend. And then there's more on Trump's quiet VP search. Former President Trump sealed the Republican presidential nomination nearly 2 months ago, and for more than 2 weeks, he has been occupied by a criminal trial in New York. And one of the ideas that simply won't go away, nor should it, is that with the campaign really in a very one-sided state, Joe Biden has been particularly active. He's been traveling around the country. He's supposed to be stopping in Seattle over the weekend, and all of that going on. And President Trump basically is dealing with a courtroom in New York. And he had some company today when he arrived for his trial, this being the hush money trial, to hear the conclusion of the cross-examination and then the redirect facing Stormy Daniels. And then listening to a bunch of other witnesses who talk about his financial handling of the payoff money to Stormy Daniels to keep her quiet. Didn't work very well. She didn't keep that quiet, and people did obviously begin to find out, as the whole world knows now, about Stormy Daniels. Senator Rick Scott, not to be confused with Tim Scott, who's the senator from South Carolina, Senator Rick Scott is from Florida, and he accompanied Trump into the courtroom to show solidarity. Is that possibility having to do with his wanting to be considered for a vice presidential nod? He has been governor of Florida. He was a two-term governor of Florida, who was very successful in a key state. But then again, he would have the same problem that Ron DeSantis would have, that Byron Donalds would have, that Marco Rubio would have. They're all from Florida. And so is President Trump. And under the 12th Amendment of the Constitution, that would mean forfeiting the 29 electoral votes from the Sunshine State, which obviously no Republican can win without. So Senator Scott, who accompanied President Trump into the courtroom, compared his own experiences to Trump's criminal cases. This is clip 17.
I'm here because I've known Donald Trump a long time. I knew him before I was governor. I consider him a friend. And what he is going through is just despicable. It's a crime in this country to use the court system to go after your political opponents. What's happening in this courtroom is clearly criminal. It's been led by political thugs. Look, I've had experience with this. Back in the 90s, I was the lead opponent to Hillary Care, Hillary Clinton's health care. After it was defeated, she used the Justice Department to go after me and my company. This can't continue. What's happening to this president is wrong.
Okay, again, to bring up his own experience dealing with charges and serious charges against him and against his company, it's unbecoming. I mean, President Trump is one of the most powerful politicians in the country. So is Rick Scott. He's a member of the U.S. Senate. And the obsession with victimhood is problematic. Meanwhile, maybe not quite as problematic as RFK Jr.'s brain worm. That was a subject for a lot of comedy of an unusual nature you don't expect in the campaign. Here was the comment from The Daily Show's Jordan Klepper, clip 12.
RFK Jr. had a worm that was eating his brain, or that his brain is so poisoned it killed the worm. It's so wild that we've all been joking about how RFK Jr. must have brain worms, and then he actually has brain worms. The story actually came out because the New York Times found a 2012 deposition from Kennedy's divorce, in which he argued that his earning power had diminished because, quote, I have cognitive problems, clearly. So I guess his argument now is, no, the worm didn't eat the president part of my brain. Just the part that has to give my ex-wife money.
And then Stephen Colbert on the same issue, clip 11.
The New York Times published some newly discovered health records for the independent presidential candidate. Turns out back in 2010, RFK Jr. went to a doctor because he was experiencing some cognitive symptoms like memory loss and mental fogginess, as well as a tiny voice in his head going, let's see, what wine pairs best with cerebellum? Lowly, that's lowly, isn't it? Busy town? Now, playing it safe, Bobby Jr. got a brain scan, which showed an abnormality that his doctor said was caused by a worm that got into my brain and ate a portion of it and then died. Cause of death? Starvation. But, you know what?
There's much, much more. We'll talk to Jonathan Allen from NBC News about what is happening on the campaign trail and about Robert F. Kennedy's challenge to debate President Trump. He does not have a high hopes of getting President Biden to debate him, but he says, RFK Jr., that he is going after the same voters who are considering President Trump. I wonder how many people out there who know they can't vote for Biden, but they can't decide between Donald Trump and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. By the way, aside from the brain-eating worms with which he has a problem, he also has a problem with a candidate eating, or at least a candidate mocking, cousin. His first cousin, who is the grandson of President John F. Kennedy, the son of Caroline Kennedy, Stolberg. In any event, Schlossberg. He has put forward a viciously anti-Kennedy tape. Does that matter? What does matter? We'll talk to Jonathan Allen coming up. And on the Michael Medved Show, Jonathan Allen joins us. He is the senior political correspondent for NBC Network. He is the author of the number one best-selling history of the Joe Biden campaign in 2020. The book is called Lucky, but it certainly looks like Joe Biden is going to have to ask for a lot of luck this time, with a great deal of political controversy and trouble, and the current polls showing him behind President Trump by narrow margins, but in six of the seven decisive swing states. Jonathan Allen, watching the Stormy Daniels testimony, of course nobody can watch it except people in the courtroom, but following the sketches and the press descriptions, do you think this case is going to end up helping or hurting Trump, or does it depend on a verdict?
You know, there are so many permutations of calculations that would have to go into figuring that out, and I do think the verdict probably matters to that, but I'm not sure exactly how. You know, I think that of the things that Donald Trump has been charged with, falsifying business records in order to, to hide an alleged sexual affair that he denies happened is, you know, probably the least substantial in terms of the effect on the rest of the public. And so that may be something that voters largely dismiss one way or the other. I mean, certainly the people who are critics of him will add this to their quiver of arrows of reasons to be against him, and those who are for him may look past it. And I suspect other people in the middle will largely look past this one. But at the moment he's in court, he's defending himself, there are a lot of ways it could go.
In terms of the ways it will go, does part of that depend on whether people are sympathetic to Stormy Daniels herself? And has she had enough of an actual video presence? Has she had enough exposure in this trial to generate a sympathy from the public at large?
That's a great question. And, there are sort of two audiences, right? You've got the one in the courtroom, meaning particularly the jurors. And I think, you know, some of the details she offered, tend to go to credibility. If she can identify what aftershave the former president uses, that would seem to bolster her story that she was at least in his room. And at the same time, having his, the alleged intimate details of his sex life revealed in a courtroom may produce some sympathy for him inside the courtroom. Outside the courtroom, again, I think most people are going to go back into their reflexive partisan corners on this. And I suspect most people who are undecided voters will make their decisions on something other than Stormy Daniels.
Recently, they had the primary, Republican primary in Indiana. And a non-candidate, Nikki Haley, who withdrew months ago, won 22% of the Republican vote. Now, it's an open primary, so Democrats could vote on the Republican side. Should that be a matter of some concern to Trump's ongoing campaign?
I mean, yes and no. I think they would obviously like to be winning by larger margins over what is effectively a zombie candidate, right? Somebody whose name is on the ballot but not actually running. At the same time, Trump didn't run in Indiana. He didn't have to mount a campaign there. Certainly some of the people who are registered as Republicans are people who voted for Joe Biden last time. But that number, 22%, is a big one. And that's something they should be concerned about. Not so much in Indiana, where I think, former President Trump will prevail in November, but the sort of ongoing difficulty of having a significant share of the Republican Party voting against him in primary suggests that there's at least some openness among some of those people to vote for Biden. And, in elections that are decided, in the recent elections, at least by tens of thousands of people across several states, any little hiccup in your support is magnified.
And what about the vice presidential choice? You still putting all your chips on Kristi Noem, are you?
I am not putting all my chips on Kristi Noem. I think, you know, she had, it's not just that she shot a dog, which I think there are many Republicans who are unsympathetic to and independent voters who are unsympathetic to, but that she chose to put that in her memoir thinking that it was good politics and then chose to continue along a broadcast book tour defending herself in ways that were not helpful. Donald Trump makes his own decisions. It's always possible he will choose Kristi Noem, but I can't imagine anyone advising him that that's a good idea at this point.
Do you think that given the trial and the Stormy Daniels impact, if any, that he is more likely than ever to select a female running mate?
I'm not sure that's the case. Certainly, I think he will review the options, and there are reasons for a number of the people who have been mentioned as possibilities to be on his ticket, but I'm not sure that that necessarily is something that he needs to do. I think persuadable voters are largely going to be thinking about economic conditions rather than an alleged affair from a long time ago, because that doesn't affect them personally the way that inflation does, or the way that immigration does, or if they are worried about threats to our democracy, how that may affect them. So or abortion. You know, there's so many issues that are very substantive for people looking forward that I think Stormy Daniels will be a footnote in this election.
And what about the other issue that's very much front and center right now, which is President Biden's pause on providing promised aid to Israel? Does this have the possibility of mobilizing new and intense opposition from supporters of Israel?
Yes, in a word. He is somebody who on one hand says that he will always support Israel's right to defend itself, and on the other hand is saying he's not going to give them bombs to have a major operation in Rafah. His message is muddled at best. There are certainly people within his own party who are supporters of Israel who are unhappy with him today.
Obviously independent voters and others. Jonathan Allen, always a pleasure speaking to you. And some of your most recent commentary is posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. When we come back, some of the most respected senators in terms of foreign policy and people who have allied with President Biden on getting aid into Ukraine, for instance, some of those people are very, very disappointed in the President of the United States. We will get to that and more coming up on The Medved Show.
You are the greatest guy on this earth.
Michael Medved.
I listen to this show 4 hours a day. It's seriously the greatest show on earth.
Listen to The Michael Medved Show.
Michael Medved Show, three very prominent Republican senators joined together today for a press conference about the president's deeply controversial and many would say outrageous decision to pause aid to Israel that had already been promised, already been committed, already been authorized by both the House and the Senate, signed into law by the president. Now he is trying to pause that aid as a means of getting Israel to stop its determined attack to wipe out the last four remaining battalions of Hamas terrorists. And Joni Ernst of Iowa and Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Tom Cotton of Arkansas got together to put the president's decision in perspective. Here is Senator Joni Ernst.
The president is a tool, folks. He is a tool. Okay, in this case, he's a propaganda tool. But Hamas is using him, and he is allowing it, and he is turning his back on Israel. So our message today should be to remember, Mr. President, Hamas created the humanitarian disaster in Gaza. Hamas knew exactly what would happen when they attacked on October 7th. They knew that Israel would respond and that they would strive for victory and the destruction of Hamas.
And the idea that Hamas deliberately wanted to use an attack on Israel to win world sympathy against Israel, the idea that this is working and working with the White House is shocking and appalling. So said Senator Lindsey Graham.
I think Israel is in a fight for its life. That the reason so many Palestinians have been killed is because Hamas has command centers under hospitals. Hamas uses the Palestinian people as human shields. Don't reward their behavior. What you're doing is you're saying Hamas has put Palestinians in the crosshairs of Israel, so stand Israel down? That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my friggin' life. Is that you tell the person who's about to be wiped off the map, you got to slow down because your enemy is making it hard on the Palestinian people to survive because they choose to put them in harm's way. That is ass backwards.
And he is frontwards. He is correct on that perception. Going more extremely than some of his colleagues, as he has wont to do, there's Senator Tom Cotton, a decorated Army veteran, graduate of Harvard Law School, among other things, and the senator from Arkansas. Clip 9.
It's now plain what we suspected all along. Joe Biden's de facto position is for a Hamas victory over Israel. Israel's goal is simple. Rescue the hostages, including American hostages, and destroy Hamas to get justice for the worst atrocity against Jews since World War II and to prevent the next atrocity. Hamas's goal is also simple. Survive. Hamas's leaders and its last four battalions are holed up in Rafah, so Israel has to defeat Hamas in Rafah to win. Hamas wins if it survives in Rafah. And Joe Biden has threatened to withhold weapons from Israel for fighting in Rafah. Therefore, Joe Biden objectively favors a Hamas victory over Israel. It's just that simple. And the president is only emboldening Hamas. Why would Hamas release hostages when Joe Biden will give Hamas exactly what it wants, survival without releasing hostages?
Okay, those questions are unanswerable. And I think it's interesting that the administration hasn't even attempted to answer them. There is another piece by Tom Friedman, who has been a very, very big critic of Bibi Netanyahu and of Israel's current right-wing government. But he has a terrific column on why the campus protests are so troubling. It appears today in the New York Times. And he writes, when people chant slogans like from the river to the sea, they are essentially calling for the erasure of the state of Israel, not a two-state solution. They are arguing that the Jewish people have no right to self-determination or self-defense. I don't believe that about Jews. And I don't believe that about Palestinians, he writes. He goes on to say, Hamas is not against just the post-1967 occupation of the West Bank. It is against the existence of a Jewish state at all and believes there should be an Islamic state between the river and the sea. When protests on college campuses ignore that, they are part of the problem, just as much as Israeli supporters who ignore the fact that the far-right members of Netanyahu's own coalition government are for a Jewish state from the river to the sea. which the United States does not support, never has. The third reason that these protests have become part of the problem is that they ignore the view of many Palestinians in Gaza, and this is the important part, who detest Hamas autocracy. These Palestinians are enraged by precisely what these student demonstrations are against. Ignore. Hamas launched this war without permission from the Gazan population and without preparation for Gazans to protect themselves. When Hamas knew that a brutal Israeli response would follow. In fact, a Hamas official said at the start of the war that its tunnels were for only its fighters, not civilians. My view, Hamas was ready to sacrifice thousands of Gazan civilians to win the support of the next global generation on TikTok, and it worked. But one reason it worked was a lack of critical thinking by too many in that generation, the result of a campus culture that has become way too much about what to think and not how to think. There was a political analyst, a Palestinian, who is now an American, but who's had family who's died in the war. And he says, having grown up in Gaza, I experienced Hamas's rise to power and their gradual grip over the Strip and Palestinian politics and society, hiding behind a resistance narrative and using extremist politics to sabotage prospects for a peaceful solution of the conflict with Israel. Months before October 7th, tens of thousands of Gazans protested in the streets in defiance of Hamas, just as they had in 2019 and 2017. Al-Khatib, who's the name of the commentator who grew up in Gaza, added that the We Want to Live protest movement decried living conditions and employment in Gaza, as well as the lack of a political horizon for meaningful change in the territory's realities and opportunities. Hamas's regime consisted of a criminal and despotic enterprise that used Gaza as a haven for the group's members and affiliates and turned Palestinians there into aid-dependent subjects reliant on the international community, and turned Gaza into a resistance citadel that was part of a nefarious regional alliance with Iran. Now, that's a statement of somebody, again, who said that he has 31 family members who have died in this war. And he blames the right perpetrator. The perpetrator are the ones who started the war. In other words, Hamas. There's also a legal war going on about whether a high school student should be permitted in class to mention the phrase illegal alien. Or is that equivalent to the N-word? We will get to that and more coming up on The MedVed Show. Sometimes there are columnists who deserve recognition on the Michael Medved Show who are just brilliant and spot on and full of foresight and almost a prophetic ability to analyze what's down the road. There's a column that we found. It was published in December of 2016. Which is right after President Trump won the election and he was coming into power. And the title of the column was The Real Two-State Solution, Eliminate Hamas. And the columnist says the Trump administration should provide strong, unequivocal support for the Palestinian people in conquering their most deadly enemy. No, that's not the Israelis. It's the gang of murderous thugs known as Hamas. the brutal Islamist fanatics who rule over Gaza. Hamas rejects all calls for negotiation, embraces terrorist violence as a holy cause, and rejects the idea of any sort of Jewish state, regardless of borders. Spot on. You know who wrote that? Me.
That was a shameless plug. Stay tuned for more shameless plugs right here on The Michael Medved Show.
You bet. And it's actually up on Substack right now. It's part of our Throwback Thursday policy of going back and checking out how accurate or inaccurate we were in previous columns and commentaries. That one from 2016, believe it or not, 8 years ago. And check it out at michaelmedved.substack.com. And that's also posted along with our podcast about what is truly unique about President Trump's sex scandal and why it's different from other presidential sex scandals. And actually different in a way that might even throw some credit in the direction of President Trump. Meanwhile, somebody who doesn't get credit is the school official who is now under suit in North Carolina. A story from the News Observer in North Carolina says that a family has filed a federal lawsuit against a school district that suspended their son for saying in class that illegal aliens, and that's in quotes, need green cards.
Excuse me?
Christian McGee asked his English teacher at Central Davidson High School whether her reference to the word aliens referred to space aliens or illegal aliens who need green cards. She had put the word aliens on the board. A Christian was suspended for 3 days for making a, quote, racially motivated and racially insensitive column, a comment. There is nothing inappropriate about saying aliens need green cards, and there certainly isn't a case for racism due to the fact that alien is not a race, so said Leah McGee, who is Christian's mother. She said that during comments at this week's Davidson County School Board meeting. Publicity about the suspension has sparked national attention and outrage among some conservatives. Elon Musk, the owner of X, formerly called Twitter, has called the suspension absurd. And on this one, I think Elon Musk is right, don't you? Upon his return to English class, the word aliens was used during class discussion, according to the lawsuit. A Christian raised his hand and asked Ms. Hill whether the reference to aliens referred to space aliens or illegal aliens who needed green cards. Hill responded and said, that's the teacher, watch your mouth. A Hispanic classmate joked he was going to kick Christian's beep, according to the lawsuit. Both students were called into the assistant principal, Eric Anderson's office. The classmate later told Christian he wasn't upset or offended by his question, according to the lawsuit. The following day, Christian received a 3-day suspension from school. The track athlete was also barred from participating in the senior night home track meet. The lawsuit contains a copy of the school suspension notice, which says, quote, Christian made a racially insensitive comment in class today about an alien needing a green card. The notice also accuses him of making racially motivated comment, which disrupted the class. According to the lawsuit, Anderson, the principal, assistant principal, told Christian's parents that reversing the suspension would be unfair to the 15 other kids who have served suspensions for saying the N-word or anything. Okay, saying the N-word is unequivocally racist. It is not a reputable word to use under any circumstances. And yes, you can understand you should be suspended for using the N-word in class. But the term illegal alien First of all, illegal aliens can be from Asia, they can be from Europe, they can be from the Middle East, they can be from anywhere. And the idea that it is a racial lawsuit, the lawsuit claims that Christian's words were racist or caused a significant disruption. Instead, the lawsuit says alien, illegal alien, and green card are common terms, and that Christian made a factual and non-threatening statement. Aliens, yes, do need green cards and want them, because a green card gives you the right of permanent residence here. And then you're no longer an illegal alien. The lawsuit says the family withdrew Christian from school after receiving threats and being bullied and harassed about the suspension. He is now being homeschooled. Isn't this a little bit outrageous? And maybe, in fact, more than a little bit outrageous? How about countering that with something outrageously great? Going back in time a little bit, tomorrow we're going to be reviewing, among other films, this brand new TV series. It's a 6-episode series about Benjamin Franklin. There was a prior effort that came out in 2008 that I think was frankly one of the best things ever made for TV. It's about another founding father, John Adams. Here's my review.
Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
For Independence Day, it's appropriate to take a look at the Atlas of Independence. That's what they called John Adams, the subject of one of the best TV miniseries ever made, available in 7 episodes streaming on HBO.
I see a new nation ready to take its place in the world. Not an empire, but a republic. And a republic of laws, not men.
That's Paul Giamatti playing America's second president, with Laura Linney as his brilliant and indispensable wife Abigail. This 2008 miniseries, directed by Tom Hooper of The King's Speech, is a sweeping triumph, intimate and grand at the same time. All credit to Tom Hanks, the executive producer who brought this gift to television. 4 stars for one of the best accounts you'll ever see about America's struggle for independence.
This feature brought to you by the Thank Heaven Foundation.
And on the Michael Medved Show, coming up tomorrow, we will be joined by Ralph Peters, who is a veteran officer in the U.S. Army, intelligence officer, and prolific novelist and foreign policy analyst.